This is What Does It Profit? And I'm your host, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. Here we are in the middle of season three. For those of you new to the show, welcome. We are the podcast about the social and moral value of economic life. As you might imagine, our podcast covers all manner of things. But this season, we seem to have found an idea that weaves a thread through everything. No big shocker. Let me remind you, if you are listening to my voice, you've survived a global pandemic. But let's not forget, there are others who didn't. But you know, it's the resilience of the human spirit. Go back and listen to Gina Schaefer from Recovery Hardware, or our last episode with the baristas from Starbucks. But let's get real. Trauma does a lot of things. For one, it changes your perspective. In my neighborhood, they call it the Soviet Safeway. It's my local grocery store. They call it this because it's run down and its inventory always seems a little lacking. But let me tell you, it was a lifesaver for our neighborhood during the pandemic. So there I was the other day, trolling around the store trying to figure out what's for dinner. By the prices of things, I was thinking about rice and beans. But then I popped over to the meat case just for the fun of it and got to thinking. In my socially conscious world, we think a lot about the impact of industrial animal farming. The environmental impacts, the antibiotics, not to mention the animal cruelty. But what we really don't think enough about is the human cost of the meat we eat. Today's story makes me sad, but it really makes me mad. We're going to Nebraska. In the spring of 2020, Dulce Castaneda was living in Crete, Nebraska with her parents. She remembers when their lives were forever changed by the COVID-19 pandemic.
Things were changing quickly. You know, you started to watch people wear masks. And so all of these changes were happening. And yet my dad was still going to the plant. Things were just going on and the same as always.
Her dad works at the meatpacking plant, a place called Smithfield.
I always describe Smithfield as the backbone of our local economy.
In 2020, Smithfield confirmed its first case of COVID-19. Dulce worried her dad could be exposed to the virus at work.
You know, masks weren't required. There wasn't hand sanitizer. There wasn't social distancing. So that's, I think, when we became alarmed, because we thought, you know, at the very least, you should have a mask on. And that wasn't happening. So I was thinking, you know, why aren't they doing anything in the plant if everything else outside seems to have changed? Why are things kind of going on as usual?
Throughout the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, there was a lot of concern about the country's food supply, specifically meat shortages. But as the coronavirus spread throughout the meatpacking plants across the country, it became clear that conditions in these plants were often dangerous. And many of these workers weren't speaking up because they were afraid of being fired. So, Dulce and the other adult children of these meatpacking workers banded together to advocate for their parents and loved ones. They called themselves the Children of Smithfield.
We started speaking out for them because we thought, we have nothing to lose. We're not going to get fired. If they're going to come for anyone, they're going to come for us, and they can't touch us.
COVID-19 spread among workers at Smithfield. Dulce says her dad watched as his co-workers, including someone next to him on the processing line, got sick.
He had a couple people that he worked closely with, and one of them tested positive. And his friend called him and said, hey, I tested positive. You should probably go get tested. And his face, it was just like disbelief, concern, worry, just, you know, all the feelings. The plant wasn't doing contact tracing. So it was really up to the workers to look out for each other and to make those calls. Even though the plant, like HR, had literally told workers not to share their test results with anyone, like outside of the HR office. So it was pretty much the message that just keep doing what you're told.
When a Smithfield employee died of complications of COVID-19, this is how the company responded.
They would put up a photo of, you know, the worker who had passed away on sort of like the announcements board. And so my dad would come home and said there was another picture up today. And that's how he found out, like, so-and-so died. And so there was never anything official.
Dulce says if Smithfield wasn't going to protect the workers, the children of Smithfield were. They demanded protective gear, paid sick leave, and distancing inside the crowded plants.
It took like months for them to, you know, start giving out face masks. Even then, it was an issue because the masks would become soiled with blood as workers were working, and they weren't given like a second face mask or a replacement.
Dulce says her 60-year-old dad has worked at the plant throughout the entire COVID-19 pandemic. He has tested positive for the virus 3 times. Years before the pandemic, Dulce says her parents emigrated from Mexico to work in the meatpacking industry.
That's kind of what drew them to Nebraska in the first place.
They moved to Crete in the mid-1990s when her dad got a job at Smithfield. Crete's a small town of about 7,000 people. Throughout her childhood, Dulce says she saw new families move in to work in meatpacking too.
I remember when we moved there, you know, there were maybe 5 Latino families. It was a very white town, not much racial diversity, and it's been just fascinating to watch it change over the last, you know, 25 years.
The meatpacking industry used to be a largely white, middle-class workforce. But then in the 1980s, meatpacking unions were gutted. So companies began recruiting refugees and new immigrants as a source of inexpensive labor they thought would be unlikely to organize. During this time period, Debbie Berkowitz says the industry also became highly concentrated.
The meatpacking industry is now dominated by just a few huge billion-dollar companies with names like Tyson, JBS Pilgrim's Pride, Cargill, Smithfield, that have all gobbled up smaller companies.
Debbie is the Worker Safety and Health Program Director at the National Employment Law Project. She's also a former official with OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration.
So now you have really a handful of players dominating the industry. They have endless resources. They have enormous profits that they've made, and they plow it, you know, because they can join together now. They're one big company, and they have enormous influence, you know, using lobbying money. And I've never really seen this in any other industry. The power of big meat is huge.
Today, Crete's biggest employer is the meatpacking plant owned by Smithfield Foods, one of the largest meatpacking companies in the world. Throughout her childhood, Dulce's dad was primarily a line worker, removing bones from ham.
There's kind of a conveyor belt, and there's pieces of meat sort of going down the belt, and each person is responsible for taking out like a part of the bone. He's responsible for one of the bones, and so he sort of works around the meat and takes that bone out. That's how he's sort of described the work, and that's what he does every day. He has a knife, and so every day it's kind of the same motion, you know, trying to dig out that bone.
For Dulce's family, a job at Smithfield offered them a chance to achieve the American dream.
I think that, you know, more than like a line worker, I think of my dad as a businessman. And I think a lot of people don't see that there's so much more to a person than, you know, I think often the plans, they're kind of disregarded. They're seen as replaceable, expendable. But there's so much more than a line worker.
But with the gains Dulce's family made by moving to Crete, her dad also gave up a lot by working at Smithfield. Even in non-pandemic times, his job is considered to be one of the most hazardous in the country. Debbie says workers are exposed to hazardous chemicals and can be cut by sharp equipment or develop carpal tunnel syndrome from the fast and repetitive work.
Workers are making thousands and thousands of the same cut a day, holding a knife or a scissor. It's cold, it's slippery, it's very forceful.
In March 2020, working at a meatpacking plant became even more dangerous. As cases of COVID-19 began to rise at meatpacking plants across the country, Dulce says she began hearing about employees at the facility in Crete who were sick, still going into work. But Nebraska Governor Pete Ricketts refused to intervene. In April 2020, Governor Ricketts held a press conference. He was asked if he'd ever consider closing down the state's meatpacking plants.
I don't foresee a scenario where I would tell them to close.
Later, an investigation by ProPublica revealed that Smithfield's chief executive, Kenneth Sullivan, sent a letter to Governor Ricketts. In part, it read, "We are increasingly at a very high risk that food production employees and others in critical supply chain roles stop showing up for work." He added, social distancing was, quote, "a nicety that makes sense only for people with laptops." Soon afterwards, the children of Smithfield decided to take to the streets to protest. They organized a socially distanced car protest at the meatpacking plant in Crete, honking their horns in solidarity with the workers who were afraid to speak up. For the children of Smithfield, it was a reminder that they could enact change. And when the plant in Crete closed for 2 weeks after a spike in COVID-19 cases, it felt like a win. But the feeling didn't last long. Smithfield reversed their decision to close the plant, despite workplace concerns. Things got worse. In April 2020, President Trump issued an executive order to keep plants open. Workers had had enough. Up until now, workers hadn't spoken out for fear of retaliation. But shortly after Smithfield officials announced the facilities would remain open, at least 50 employees of the plant in Crete walked off the job in protest.
After originally being told that the Smithfield food processing plant in Crete would be closed for 2 weeks, workers were ordered back online Tuesday on a reduced schedule.
And that momentum continued. The plant's parking lot gave way to a parade of cars as workers and other community members cheered and held up homemade signs that read, "Our parents are essential, not dispensable." For Crete, this was a historic moment.
I think it maybe lasted like an hour or so, but that was, I think, maybe the first time in Crete's history that something like that has happened, which is remarkable.
While conditions somewhat improved at the Smithfield plant, Governor Ricketts dealt another blow in May 2020. He said meatpacking plants no longer have to report COVID-19 cases, even though case counts continued to rise.
We're only going to report it aggregately across the state and not for individual facilities because, guess what, sometimes people don't tell the truth. We've had a number of cases where somebody said, "I tested positive and I worked for this company," except they didn't work for that company.
The children of Smithfield continued to protest and advocate for their parents. In 2021, Dulce and Debbie spoke at a House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing. They talked about the dangerous conditions workers faced at the Smithfield plant in Crete during the pandemic. Debbie says many of the large plants had outbreaks where more than 1,000 workers got sick, and many died.
Many meat processing plant workers are now protesting orders to remain on the job.
Meatpacking plants closing all across the country and putting a huge strain on our food supply chain.
A cluster of infections popped up among workers at Smithfield Foods in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Studies show that meatpacking workers and their communities suffered disproportionately high rates of COVID-19 during the first year of the pandemic. Meatpacking plants also have, overall, serious injury and illness rates 3 times the national average. To make matters worse, Debbie says the meatpacking industry hid their data. The House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Crisis published a report in 2021. They found that infections and deaths at 5 of the industry's biggest companies were much higher than previously known. Because so many workers got the disease, some meatpacking companies reported labor shortages at their processing plants. To fill these spots, Debbie says children have been hired illegally to clean these plants.
Most meatpacking plants run 2 shifts to get all the meat and poultry we all need to eat and export. to 8-hour shifts. And then the night shift, the 8-hour shift, is sanitation, where they use high pressure hoses and they clean this really dangerous equipment that, you know, if it moves in the wrong direction, you can lose a leg, you can lose a hand, people die doing this because it's so dangerous. And over the last, 15 years, the meat industry has really outsourced this work because it's so dangerous. They don't want to put the injuries on their records. So they want to say they're safe. So they hire another company to do it.
One of those companies is Packers Sanitation Services, Inc. The U.S. Department of Labor said Packers illegally hired at least 102 children. Their jobs included cleaning meat and bone cutting saws and other dangerous equipment. Debbie says companies like to hire children because
they work for cheap and lower wages, and they won't speak up for unsafe conditions.
And when we think about the human cost of the meat we eat, how does this story work out? In the opinion of this podcast host, it really hasn't worked out at all. It's a question of power. Who stands up for the workers? The kids. Who stands up for the kids? That's a story for another episode. But suffice to say, it's not the terrified families or the traffickers who bring these kids to factory towns. To be fair, within the last year, the Labor Department's Wage and Hour Division conducted an investigation into Packers Sanitation Service, and authorities levied the highest civil fines available under the law, $15,138 a child. Just doesn't seem enough. There are a lot of things that went wrong, but there's something that you can do. Join the movement to understand the human cost of the meat we eat. And to my mind, we eat broccoli or we call Congress. In our last episode, I lamented about the labor problems at my beloved Starbucks. And ever since, I've been standing by waiting for the results of that proxy vote.
We could sense that a lot of investors felt that, there's something gone wrong at this company and they want to send a message to the board that it's time to kind of reframe how they approach these issues.
That's Tom Powdrell, the head of stewardship at one of the four activist shareholder groups that brought the proxy question on worker rights to the Starbucks shareholders. We'll hear more from Tom in a bonus episode at the end of the season. At the time of this recording, Starbucks still hasn't released the results of the vote. What Does It Profit is a production of the Solidarity Economy Workshop at Georgetown University. The show is hosted by me, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. Jordan Gaspore is our senior producer. Special thanks to our Season 3 researchers and assistant producers, Sophia Chen, Hannah Woodford, and Andy Fang. Music for What Does It Profit was composed by Nick Pennington. Support for What Does It Profit is provided by the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor, the McDonough School of Business, and the Capital Applied Learning Lab at Georgetown University. You can learn more at whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. And just before we let you go, remember, never stop asking yourself, in the work that you do and the investments that you make, what does it profit?